How do we enable airmen, specifically our Spark cells, to get after innovation themselves? How do we increase the rate of experimentation so that we can find the diamonds in the rough? Because there's a lot going on out there. Not everything deserves to make it to production. But if we don't experiment well, we won't be at the cutting edge.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Through our blood and your bonds, we crushed the Germans before he got here.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
All right, here we are again. I've got another defense maverick in the wild sitting with here talking with me. I'm Bonnie Evangelista with the Chief Digital and Artificial Intelligence Office. I've got Victor Salsa Lopez from the Air Force. Victor, or Salsa, can you give me a quick rundown? Who are you? Where do you work? And what's your expertise?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Bonnie, for having me and for the CDAO team, for all that you all do. Really excited to hang out with you all for this hour. I am a Reaper pilot in the Air Force that has chosen a very odd path, as many, I'm sure, of the other Mavericks on your show will say. I got about 2,000 or so hours. I'm still flying actively in the Reaper community, flying my combat missions. But in 2019, I was asked by the Vice Chief to help stand up a artificial intelligence accelerator, a research and development unit at Massachusetts Institute of Technology under the new Department of the Air Force and MIT Artificial Intelligence Accelerator, where we worked on fundamental research. And I really focused in on small UAS research, so like quadcopter, little tiny airplanes. How do they work together and how do they work with humans in kind of a multi-agent, like human-machine team, kind of looking towards the CCA future, right? After about 3 years or so of doing that, I got asked to go and put all of that hard work into practice. And so now I am at AFWERX working on robotics and artificial intelligence as part of the Spark branch, Spark Directorate under the ARC branch. And so our job is to try and find where all these technologies actually fit within the operational world and make sure that they're tactically relevant for the warfighter.
Are you still a pilot?
I am still a pilot, still flying. Yeah, I got to go in a couple of weeks here.
I feel like that's so unusual in a good way that you're an operational user, but you're also kind of in the middle of this, how do I bring technology to my world? How did that happen? I don't understand.
Yeah, I think a lot of luck and was it luck plus preparation equals opportunity, I think is the winning formula, right? So, you know, back in 2019, I was finishing up my graduate degree in systems engineering at Georgia Tech and really focusing on rapid development of military technology. Before that, I had gotten an undergraduate degree in astronautical engineering from the Air Force Academy. And those kind of two things together, I got lucky in my first operational unit that was very forward-leaning. And we did a lot of really fun operational tests in combat with things that were brand new that we hadn't tested before. And they would ask us to use it. And because of my engineering background, I got to help lead a lot of those efforts as I grew into my career field, which was so much fun. Because of all of that, my resume was highlighted whenever they were looking for airmen, operational airmen, to staff the AI accelerator. Because we knew that it was going to take more than just the R&E, the S&T folks, if you will, who are brilliant in what they do. We wanted to make sure that we were able to connect all the way back down to the tactical end user and to the program office to enable the transition of all the new technology. And that was so important. And so myself and 10 other tactically and operationally relevant, very young captain types, staff sergeant types, staffed this unit to really get after it. And part of that was because I was leaving my career field too early. We were making a lot of change, and Vice Chief Wilson really had the forethought to bring in those young folks. But that meant that I had to keep flying. Otherwise, the Air Force would get upset because we were going to rock the boat a little bit too much. And so we said, hey, go figure out how to fly. Thankfully, the Pennsylvania Air National Guard out in Willow Grove has been gracious enough to host me. And so they have been hosting my flying hours for the last 4 or 5 years now. And I've gotten the chance to fly with folks from all over the country now, which has been so much fun to stay combat relevant, but also still get to be in this S&T and AI world.
How long have you been called Salsa?
Oh, goodness. So call signs are earned in the Reaper community, as in many other communities. They are not something that you call yourself. Someone else has to give them to you. I would have not have chosen this name, and I did not like it whenever I initially was told that it was going to be mine. So back in, it would have been 2017-ish, my unit decided that I was worthy of a call sign. So you go from being the friggin' new guy to a named person in the unit. So I was more than just a number. And it kind of signals acceptance into the unit. And it really draws its history all the way back to World War One. You know, back in the day before we had things like Blue Force Tracker and Link 16 that could tell us where everybody was, and really good radios that, you know, we could communicate on, or even Merc Chat nowadays, right, where we have chat rooms for wartime. Back then, you didn't know who came home until you came home. And you'd go to the bar and you would have a roll call and you would have everyone's name up on the board. And you go through everyone's name. And if they respond that they're present, you knew they made it home. And if they didn't respond, you knew to have a drink in their honor. And so from that, you know, heritage and history of the Air Force, we've continued these traditions throughout. And so today, squadrons, you know, bestow these names in a roll call scenario where the entire squadron gets together and they deem you worthy of having a call sign. They kick us all out and they go and decide on it, and they bring you back in, and they usually will give you your name first and then explain it to you after. I tried to drink my name off, I think, 10 times, or I realized that everyone was really wanting to call me Salsa. And they had, like, you know, 10 different options up there. They seemed really fixated on the Salsa one. And so after they finally named me, I sat down somewhat upset, and I got pulled aside, and they told me why, and the history and the story and the thought of the acronym that Salsa stands for and the story behind it and the amount of love and care that they put into it. And you realize that, wow, like, okay, one, I should be proud that they put this much time and effort and thought into it. And it also signaled the final acceptance, right, into the squadron, which is such a big deal. And it harkens all the way back to our World War One days. So a huge source of pride for pilots. I know it's weird to the rest of the community, but it's something that is now with me forever.
I think the story helps. I'm not going to lie. I'm much more amenable to calling you Salsa. It's not as, sorry, when I say amenable, it's not that it's less weird, right? It's, you know, custom, it's not my custom, right? But
right.
I can dig that. Okay, Salsa, good. All right, so pilot turned, I don't know, innovator? That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, robotics, AI, something. Yeah, I don't know what my job is, but that's what makes it fun.
So one of the first conversations we ever had, I knew you were a defense maverick because you were telling me a story about how you were using the Doden to do experimentation. And I remember I said, you gotta say that to me, say it slower. And I was like, what are you doing? And how is this working and whatnot? So tell me a little bit more about, like, something you're working on, or like, what does life look like for you today as Salsa the innovator?
For sure. So I think part of our mission in AFWERX, and specifically within the Spark Directorate, is how do we enable airmen, you know, specifically our Spark cells, to get after innovation themselves? How do we increase the rate of experimentation so that we can find the diamonds in the rough? Because there's a lot going on out there. Not everything deserves to make it to production. But if we don't experiment well, we won't be at the cutting edge. And we have disastrous consequences if we don't make it to the cutting edge. And so one of the things that we found when I was at the AI Accelerator was infrastructure for running AI code. We knew that this was a relatively hard thing. We needed a place where airmen could go and run code. And they would tell me that it was very difficult to do that, that, you know, finding a place and getting the approvals and getting an authority to operate and authority to connect were things that are really, really difficult to do. And in large part, they're right. But one thing that a lot of folks just didn't know about was this DoD information system that you mentioned.
It was the DREN. I'm sorry. Not the DoD.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're thinking. I'm sorry.
You're fine. So the DREN, yeah. So, or DREN, I think it depends on who you are.
Oh,
I've heard it both ways. DREN or the DREN is part of the High Performance Computing Modernization Program that no one in the DoD seems to know about, but it is a DoD program owned by DISA and the DoD. It's been around for over 25 plus years. It's had over $5 billion invested into it with an annual budget of around $270 to $300 million. And on this network, Defense Research Engineering Network, you have a whole bunch of affiliated research centers, PC ARCs they're called. So these ARCs are little nodes on the network. And all these little nodes have what people in the AI world care about. And the thing that enables AI is data, compute, and algorithms. We have the algorithms on open source. Like, you can go download those on the internet today. Sometimes we have data. Sometimes it's not well organized, but we can grab that. What we kept missing is the compute part. And so we started looking in the DoD and, you know, within CDAO, you know, different government cloud solutions. And those have been great, especially when we want to scale. But when it comes to experimentation, the small stuff, a couple users just trying to figure out if this thing works, I went to the HPC ARCs, specifically one up in Rome, New York. And the folks out in Rome, New York at AFRL RI, which is the Information Directorate of Air Force Research Laboratory, have an affiliated research center that is connected and has the authority to connect to this Defense Research and Engineering Network. And there they have compute, GPUs, so graphical processing units, the kind of backbone that does all of the hard work in AI. They have places where we can store data. We bought 2 petabytes extra data that we wanted to store on there for the low price of one-time cost of $100K. We can access the compute nodes, even though it's all the way up in New York, from anywhere in the world over a terminal, which is just like a command line interface, what you might see in like the Matrix. And my team uses that plus their cat cards to log in. And we get immediate access to all this compute. And we're starting to use that now in different ways to start prototyping software and prototyping AI models that will allow us to kind of move the ball forward and actually go and put those on systems that can make a difference. And this is something that's already been paid for. So the folks up in Rome, New York, do not charge me any money for using their systems. I burned up a motherboard my team did a couple weeks ago. It was completely fried because we pushed it a little bit too hard, or maybe it was old. We're not sure. But they weren't upset about it. They just knew, hey, this is part of the thing. They moved us to a new computer. All our data was still there, and we continued working. And I started to now help seed a lot of our Spark cells and a lot of the folks who really need that capability to have compute, to be able to put it on a place that's IL5, you know, Impact Level 5 certified for controlled and classified information for CUI data. And they're really excited about that opportunity. And I'm just so thankful that this organization exists.
So what kinds of things or capabilities or tools or models are you playing with in this environment?
Man, so, you know, we have a couple programs within AFWERX, within the Prime Directorate. We have some, you know, autonomous vehicles. So we have Autonomy Prime there. So we're looking at how do we really enable like group 1 through 3. So these are like quadcopter sized to kind of like your VBAT sized, you know, maybe 6 foot tall airplanes. How do you enable those to be autonomous? How do you get them to have an autopilot? But also, how do they start to understand their world? So a lot of people will talk about autonomy in the autonomy space. I will talk about it from a robotics perspective, which is a bit different. Within the robotic space, when you're trying to build a robot, your robot needs to have a few things. It needs to be able to interact with the world somehow. It needs to be able to perceive the world. And it needs to be able to make decisions, right? And when you kind of break it down there, you start to understand how to start building and designing your robot in the way that makes sense. But I also had a lieutenant the other day reach out because he really wanted to play with large language models. That was something he was excited about. And I gave him a little bit of information, a little bit more, and he kept doing really great things. Lieutenant Nick Brooks, if he's out there. And Lieutenant Brooks goes out, and I give him some GPUs once I realize that his technical capability is pretty high. And he goes and he knocks my socks off, and he gets some demos that I had tried to build but didn't quite have the time to, all the way up to something that was ready to go and experiment with. And now he had a graphical user interface for anybody to go and interact with and have large language models on the Defense Research Engineering Network, which was huge.
You're saying he built that? He built the GUI?
Yeah, he took open source code from the world and went and put it on this network and realized that, hey, no kidding, you can run this on this thing. And Salsa figured out how to get me access through the HPC ARC in Rome, New York with AFRLRI to all this stuff. And I really didn't do much. I've connected him, helped him move things forward. But all of a sudden now he has this incredible capability that he didn't know existed, and he had to pay $0 to get it, which is just huge.
Yeah. There, so lots of things in my mind. I'm landing on this idea that the scenario you just described where a lieutenant wanted to play, you gave him the sandbox and access to the sandbox, and it had those three things you described earlier, and he could play. I think that's something a lot of people are trying to do. I can tell you at the OSD level, Deputy Secretary Hicks released her AI adoption strategy. I think it was a couple months ago now, and experimentation is a big element of that. I guess I'm wondering, how do we meet in the middle, essentially, in terms of getting to actual experimentation? Because I think when you hear someone at the OSD level saying, I want to experiment, there's a lot of churn to figure out how to do that or how to practically implement that. And I think that's where this conversation can be really cool, in my opinion, because there's a lot of people in between you and OSD. So how do we meet in the middle and proliferate more of what you're talking about, like from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, enabling experimentation, I think the deputy secretary, you know, hit the nail on the head there, is really the magic sauce. And it is for two reasons, right? The first is you won't know what works and what doesn't unless you experiment. But the second is we sometimes forget our most valuable resource, right, which is our people. And while this particular lieutenant is great, and I'm super excited that he's running through all of this, he has a day job that he has to get done, and he has responsibility there, right? But at the same time, if I don't invest in him from an education perspective, from a letting him fail perspective, and from pointing him in a direction that makes him excited, I'm going to lose the ability to grow him technically into a leader that I'm going to need in the future. And so from a leadership perspective, right, how do we meet in the middle? It's really about enabling that experimentation and not directing the direction that it goes. I didn't tell this particular lieutenant how to put something on there. I didn't direct him on which type of model to use. I didn't direct him on what open source thing. I let him go and run in the direction he thought was interesting. And in doing so, I'm helping build him. But all I've done as a leader is open up the door and let folks walk through it. And so when we talk about enabling experimentation specifically in the AI domain, we have to look at how do we enable those tools and accesses. And if people aren't using them or we don't have good utilization, whose problem is it? And a lot of times we like to force innovation and force the use of tools or mandate it through an AFI or directive. That's usually problematic. Yeah, and that's usually problematic because we don't like to think of ourselves in leadership space as providers of a service. And we don't like to think of our subordinates as customers. But at the end of the day, as a leader, that's really who you are. I am not a person, while I can give an order, those times should be far and few between. Unless, again, there's an absolute mission that we have to get done tomorrow, right? Absolutely. But in the innovation space, we have to flip a switch and realize that we are the ones providing the service. And if our customer, which in this case might be a lieutenant, could be a senior airman, could be an A1C or a private, right? They are our customer. And if they're not using our tools, it is on us to determine why our tool is failing. And that is a personal failure, a leadership failure on our part. And that can, I think, be a difficult thing to sometimes withstand as a leader that is used to being able to lead and give orders and have people follow. It's much harder to lead a volunteer organization than it is a military organization because the, you know, spaghetti stream of efforts moves everywhere. But in the innovation space, that's exactly what you want. And that's where we get the goodness of experimentation.
Yeah. That's what you're describing is pretty hard, right? I just want to foot stomp that, but it can be done. I liked your point about bringing people, end users, operational or not, to the table and giving them the recognition. I think that they, in the sense that, yes, like we are here to serve you, if that makes sense. And I think a lot of times they're used to being told what to do, right? And that they're, you know, they're given their equipment and their capabilities, and it's always somebody else telling them what's good for them, and maybe flipping the script to your point, like actually saying, hey, how can I help you? And that starts to open up the aperture for what you're talking, you know, when you talk about innovation from a practitioner's lens, that's the way I'm hearing it at least. Sorry. I was just really in the moment there. I really like that. Thank you.
I can't take credit for it. That's actually something I think I learned from the colonel who helped stand up the AI accelerator. In my first interview with Colonel Gordon, I was worried that I was not the right guy. I was like, man, I do some like maybe some programming on the side and I've done some engineering, but like I've not done a lot of AI. Like, am I the right guy? Do you want somebody else? And in my initial interview, that was my going in strategy. And what he told me within the first 5 seconds of me speaking was, Salsa, flip the script. What can I do for you? What do you need? And that had such a profound impact on me. And then while at MIT, the university students are very similar. There's an entire month that they give back to the students where there are no academics, the month of January. It's called the Independent Activities Period, where you go and do what you want. Where does your passion lie? And we have to, I think, learn how to balance the military necessity of our job, of getting the job done, flying the combat mission like I have to go do, leaving white space and giving the opportunity to go and innovate and make something different. And that can be hard.
I want to pick on the infrastructure piece for just a second, because I feel like, based on my experience, the more critical elements to giving room for play, and it has like the least conversation, I suppose. So, I mean, you were just describing, you kind of found a workaround, I suppose, in your scenario, but like, how do we think about this more broadly as a collective from your perspective? Like, why is it Salsa trying to end run compute so that, you know, he can just create that sandbox he's looking for?
Yeah, we're really bad at advertising in the DoD, and we don't do it well internally. And I am a victim of this, or I'm guilty, maybe is the right word. I don't advertise well either for any things that we have. So part of it, I think, is just knowing what's out there. You know, the DAF at least has their Big Six, which is great. These are data platforms where you can go and put data in it that are CUI. Some of them are even at Zipper. Others are at JWix. And you can go and actually get on there, put data, run Python code, run SQL, R, et cetera, all the nerdy data science things. There's things like the DREN, and there's also an SDREN, right? The secret defense research engineering network that you can go and access that, hey, by the way, has compute, has storage, right? You can go and use these things. And I think it goes back to the user experience as far as the advertisement, exposure, and ease of utilization. We do a poor job in the DoD at user experience because we don't think of ourselves, right, as the provider of a service to our customer who might be a senior airman or an A1C or a private, right? For them, what does the user experience look like to log on to your system? How many steps? How many PDFs? How many signatures? How many emails? How many routes? That can be really difficult. And if we don't get the UX right, the user experience right, we're going to continue to fail our airmen, because only the ones who have the most to gain or who are hard-headed enough, like I am, are going to push through all those bureaucratic hurdles to make it happen. So experimentation isn't only about the infrastructure, but it's also about enabling the infrastructure. And again, that's a bad thing. If no one's using your product, maybe it's a you thing, right? What does that experience look like? Maybe it's us that's the problem, not necessarily the airmen. And exactly. I think if we take that ownership, you know, head on, we start to understand how to work on what makes it better. I think the trouble for DoD that we don't have maybe in private industry, in the DoD or in the government, we don't have a bottom line. If no one uses the product, the contract's still going to get paid. You might just have poor metrics. So it's really on us and our own amount of leadership and our own humility to be able to say that we have failed at advertising these platforms. We have failed at the user experience on these platforms, and we have failed at getting them to the right folks at the right time with the right tactical understanding of where they're going to lead.
Do you have any recommendations then for anyone who's trying to navigate the spaghetti, like you called it? What can they do? Cause sometimes you're just in a position where that's happening and you still need to do something anyways, like yourself. So how are you doing it? What do you recommend for others?
I think one of the things that's been massive post pandemic, and it's something that has been written about, right? So General McChrystal wrote about this in a book called Team of Teams, something that my current boss, you know, recommended we all read. And now that I was reading it, it made a lot of sense, right? So there's leadership challenges here too that I'll get to. In Team of Teams, General McChrystal talks about the fluidity of some of the Al-Qaeda cells that we were fighting and how they would quickly reorganize after and continue to maneuver even after maybe we attacked or were able to eliminate a high-level leader from the organization. And the question was, how do they reorganize so quickly? How are they able to continue fighting when we keep knocking off their bureaucratic lists? And the answer was it was a team-to-teams approach. And what I've seen post-pandemic has been really interesting. My Microsoft Teams has blown up. I think I had maybe one team on Teams pre-pandemic where people tried to post stuff in a wiki. I have lost count as to how many notifications I get now with how many groups that I have been added to because of this team-of-teams approach, right? Same thing is happening on other platforms that are both approved and not approved for CUI, you know, that have public data or CUI data, you know, We, within AFWERX, have supported now Mattermost for the entire DoD, so you can go and actually get a Mattermost account without having to pay for it. It's already been covered through our contract. That's another place, and that is up at IL4 with an ATO, as well as IL2, depending on your needs and use cases. But this teams of team approach of starting to self-organize and share information and find the folks, right, through asking questions, will eventually lead you to the same humans. So what we find, at least in the innovation world, is it's the same humans doing the same things over and over again. It's the ones that are hard-headed enough to make the circle.
That's fair.
And by the way, they're the same people that are piping up in these chats, right? And being social about it. So between things like Teams, AFWERX has Vision and Ignite as well, which are really great platforms to go and post your innovative ideas. So that same lieutenant with the team, now it's a larger team that includes some other folks from AFRLRI and a group called Darksaber, which is a ragtag group of volunteers working to build platforms for airmen and guardians. They are, you know, put this idea for more compute in Vision. And I think they're like the number one pick. And so for like, you know, going to get funding, and they want to move forward now in Vision Oz to actually fight to get funding for this idea. So what started is like one lieutenant playing with a large language model might actually turn into a no kidding, fully funded project that moves forward for the entire DoD, which is huge, right? From a leadership perspective, however, this can be difficult. If you have a mission to get done, your combat mission, how do you allow your airmen, your guardians, your soldiers, your marine, your sailors to start self-forming teams outside of your purview? Mm-hmm. How do you give them the psychological safety to do so? How do you humble yourself to know that they might be doing something outside of your expertise, and that's okay, and allow other people to begin leading your folks without your knowledge? And that might seem like hearsay to most of the top level down, right? Like top down, very bureaucratic, very military structure. But this is something that has happened throughout the ages in warfare, right? Folks airdrop into the wrong location and have to form a team. There's a large attack and you're going to form with whoever's around you. You know, and we see this time and time again in crisis scenarios, and the military is no stranger to it. The only difference is now we're doing it online and reforming. And so it's on the subordinates to work to inform their leadership, but also on leadership to give their subordinates the psychological safety to go and do these things.
So on that note, you're making me think of a concept that I talked with the AFRL CIO, actually, Alexis Bonnell, and she talks about time as a weapon, because time is the only thing that we share with the adversary. So in this day and age, it's we have to figure out how to cheat time, essentially. Like, we need cheat codes for time. So, and she calls them wormholes. And so where can you find like the wormholes in your setting so that you can, and honestly, I think it's a symbol or an analogy for the bureaucracy. Like, what are the cheat codes for our bureaucracy so that we can just, like, to your point, get a thing done or work to, even though like we can form a team that's maybe not obvious, like nobody works for anybody, but we're just all self-forming and self-organizing like you're talking about so that we can get mission done. So I kind of want to throw that on you. Like, do you have any good cheat codes? Do you have any good wormholes? Like, what, aside from team of teams, like I got that, but like, is there anything a little bit more granular that you can offer? And that could be, you know, just like resource wise, it could be, I just have a practitioner's heart, so I'm always like trying to pick on how do I do the thing.
You know, we get this a lot, right? And like, one of the, I'll pick on one thing, which is contracting, right? Our contracting officers are great. You run Tradewinds, which is an amazing tool, but man, like, sometimes you need a cheat code, right? It's like, okay, I know I want X or Y thing. I have a week to get it. I think I found money. How the hell do I buy it? Right? That's really hard. One of the cheat codes that not a whole lot of folks use is our cyber portfolios across the government, by the way, right? So one thing that folks don't know, much like Tradewinds, right? Once a company is in the SBIR portfolio, you can sole source that company as long as it extends that SBIR, any of the SBIRs that they've ever had. They can go from a phase one directly to a phase three. There's no issue with that, as long as you have the money to go do so.
Right.
Likewise, the next problem is like, how do you go find these companies? Like, how do you know what's in the portfolio? And that's, and unfortunately, you know, if you go to AFWERX.com, I'll plug a little bit here, right? We have this tool called Vision, where you can go and put your innovative ideas and find innovators from across the, for at least the Air Force, across the Department of the Air Force. No issues expanding this across DOD either, I'm sure, if we needed to. And there's also a thing in there called Ignite. And what Ignite is a matchmaking tool for companies that have technologies that have been in the cyber portfolio to pair with airmen so that you can actually go and get your stuff done, right? Yeah. So these are some of those cheat codes that you can use. Likewise for software, right? You want to run software, but you don't have the like $600,000 to get your ATO through, you know, whatever it might be, or your 6 months or your 7 months, you need it faster than that. Can it run on something like the Defense Research Engineering Network? Is there an ARC near you that can do it, right? HPC.mil is the, you know, main website, and AFRL.HPC.mil is the Air Force side. You can go there and say, okay, knock on the door. I asked and they gave me my stuff in a couple days, yeah. Right? So that's a cheat code there for your software. And then cheat codes for advocacy, not only team of teams, right? But same thing in Vision. You can vote on projects in Vision and you can join other projects in Vision that match what you want to do. And likely if you have an idea, the base next to you probably has the same idea, right? Or at least other folks right. in your career field. But again, how do you self-organize? You have Microsoft Teams, but we also now have Vision. And you can go and vote with your and say like, hey, this is really important. And if that makes it high enough, that has visibility to the chief of staff level. Right. So now you can get into the AFWERX refinery and refine that idea for no kidding funding and POMs and StratFi TACFIs, right? Which allow you to use government and or private industry matching funds to expand the scope of your small business innovation research project, which is huge. Right. So those are some of the tools that are out there that allow you to short circuit some of the normal bureaucracy until you build enough advocacy and you've experimented enough. That you've had enough success, that you've gone through this process, that you're ready for, you know, to make this a fully funded, normal, everyday, boring business use case, and you're on to the next amazing thing.
That's awesome. I would be remiss if I didn't add a clarification for those out there, because I am a contracting professional. So when he's talking about CBER and doing direct awards, it's not a sole source in the technical sense of a sole source. Like, you don't need a JNA, justification and approval. Having a phase one or phase two CBER or SITR has met the standard of competition. But I know, like, that's another thing in our community. There's different interpretations on how that's executed. Do I have to go through a sole source activity like I would a traditional FAR contract? I would offer no, you don't, but the look and feel of it, to Salsa's point, is correct. You are working directly with a vendor one-on-one to complete, extend, or derive from their CBER technology. That's it. No JNA should be required.
That's why we have you guys to keep us safe.
Of course. There. So where do you want to land in terms of how we want to come to a close in our conversation? What else about experimentation or otherwise is resonating with you in terms of leaving us some final thoughts?
For those who have people in their charge, as we look towards the future, warfare, while the nature will continue to stay the same, right? As the character changes, how are you enabling experimentation at your level? And what resources do you need to ask for the special folks in your unit? I met a supply troop in Doha at IED last year, who before immigrating to the United States was a network engineer. And he ended up on a special task force because he was a network engineer and they needed that. But his job was supply, not networks.
That is so common.
Very, right? I've had two linguists, brilliant linguists, who have been amazing Python programmers who've helped me build products very quickly, both under the E5 level. I've had this lieutenant, right, that we talked about today. We had another senior airman become a program manager with us. He was cyber intel, but he joined the Air Force somewhat to spite his family because he had also gotten into Harvard and MIT, but decided he wanted to enlist instead. These are the special folks that our country has decided to give to us. And I think it is on us to figure out how to give them what they need to succeed, not just within the lens of their career field through a traditional career path, but in the lens of how do we prepare for the next fight and let them experiment so that we build them both personally and to build the department.
All right. Well, thank you, Salsa. Thanks for giving me a little bit of your time, creating some space for some really cool conversation. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. Super looking forward to continue working with DoD CDAO here and in the future.
All right.